Play your tile, her voice grated.
I'm thinking,
she said nothing.
Don't you want to know what I'm thinking?
He leaned back in his chair, his short silvered hair a bright bristle in the lamplight. The Emperor passed his fingers over his mouth with enough pressure to pull slightly at the slack skin of his cheeks. His touch explored the grooves age had made near his mouth, and he seemed pleased. Then she saw that his gaze had shifted to her hands. They were trembling. She pressed them down against the table.
I'm thinking about what I'll claim from you when I win, he said. The particularly appealing part of the deal you struck is the openness of your offer. Whatever you like.
She wished she'd phrased things differently, though she didn't know what else she would have said, since part of what had made him agree to the game was his anticipation of the pleasure of what he was doing now.
I could make you bring Aaron of Haran to me, the Emperor said. He'd surrender for you.
The world deadened.
I never finished what I started with that boy's face.
The Emperor pushed the hilt of Kestrel's dagger with one finger. The sound it made, though small, scraped down her spine.
Or perhaps it's not his face that appeals to me most. We could see what might be done with yours.
Silence.
No, Lady Kestrel.
His gaze drifted over her shoulder. He continued to speak, voice soft as his list continued, and Kestrel's mind jumped between thinking that he chose to name the things that would torment her most, and meant none of it, or that he did mean it, and wanted her to hope that he didn't, and that this hope was his most delicious form of brutalization. Her heart was loud in her ears. This wasn't working. She'd made a grave mistake in coming.
But of course, the Emperor finally said, with such an offer as you made, I could exact it all.
Aaron ordered his vanguard to fall to the sides of the road. The black powder sacks were lit. The Valorian cavalry reared back from what they saw too late. The sacks burst under their hooves. Chunks of paving stone exploded into the air. Do you forfeit your turn? Kestrel asked.
Not at all.
You're afraid to play?
We both know, he said. Which of us is afraid?
She reached for her wine glass and drank.
I do admire your love for a gamble.
He took her cup and drank from it as well.
I was simply thinking out loud earlier. There's no harm in thinking.
I have my own thoughts. I am wondering why my father ever respected you. The Emperor set down the cup.
He's my friend.
Yet you say the things that you say.
He's not here, and if he were, he wouldn't care.
Yes, he would. The Emperor scrutinized her.
You don't look like him, except the eyes.
Why? The word burst from her lips. His reply was gentle.
Why what, Kestrel?
Her throat closed, her eyes stung. She realized that she had forgotten the game, and that maybe this had been the Emperor's intention. She didn't want to ask her question. Yet she couldn't help it, or the hurt evident in her choked voice. Why did he choose you over me?
Ah.
The Emperor rubbed his dry palms together and templed them with a little pat.
You've provided me with an entertaining evening so far. I feel I owe you something in exchange. So, the truth. Trajan wasn't my friend. Not at first. He was necessary for what I wanted. Military prowess, imperial expansion. I, in turn, was an opportunity for what he wanted, which was nothing less than for his daughter to one day rule the Empire. An understandable ambition. Or perhaps our friendship didn't begin there, after all. We've known each other since well before your birth. He's a man of rare intelligence. There's pleasure in finding one's equal. Perhaps things began with that. As to how it has grown.
He shrugged.
Maybe it's because he knows how I am with everyone else, and knows that I'm not like that with him. I value Trajan. Ultimately, when he held your treasonous letter in his hand and saw how you had lied to him, the choice between me and you was the choice between someone who loves him and someone who didn't.
Tears spilled down her cheeks. The Emperor patted her frozen hand.
I suggest that we not discuss your father.
He played his tile. The air reeked of sulfur and scorched horseflesh. The screams were so many and so loud that Arryn couldn't really hear them. Just noise. His ears buzzed. Valorians floundered in their blood on the broken road. Ranger arrows continued to furrow the sky. A blasted paving stone, Arryn saw, had smashed into a Harani soldier's face. Her body lay half in the mud, half where the road had been. Arryn couldn't spot the general. The Valorian army was vast. Only a few ranks of cavalry had been decimated in the blast. Another unit of Valorian cavalry moved forward into position. Kestrel was losing. Earlier, the Emperor had delayed in order to unsettle her, to revel in it, to spear her like a worm and watch her writhe. Kestrel's tactic of delay was different. She took as much time as possible to draw the game out. Earlier, she'd wanted the game to be over quickly. Now she needed more time. The four shiny tiles in the boneyard winked at her. She knew their values. The wolf. She could use that if it were in her hand. Or even the bee. Her frustration rose. The tears had dried on her cheeks, the skin tight with salt. She couldn't help returning to what the Emperor had said about her father. The memory of how her father had told her that she'd broken his heart. If he were here, she would howl at him. He had broken her heart, over and over, for years. He tried to force her into the mold of his own idea of honor. What he wanted her to be, not what she was. Kestrel felt her spine straighten. Damn his devotion to honor. When it came her turn to pull a tile, she didn't choose any of the marked ones.
Steady! Arryn called.
His horse tossed its head. His vanguard still held formation, those few files of broad ranks running across the road and up to the trees. The Valorian cavalry nudged toward them, looking ready to tear through Arryn's ranks. Arryn watched the cavalry shape into a wedge. The left and right sides would pull up in the clash and would try to flank the center ranks of Arryn's army by galloping up alongside the road once Arryn's vanguard had collapsed.
Yes, said Death. Good.
The Emperor pulled a shiny tile. Kestrel bit back a sound, glancing away so that he couldn't read her expression. The windows had lightened. For the first time, she registered their intricate patterns of stained glass. In the dead of night, they'd looked black. Now they blushed with faint color. She saw what they would soon fully show. Flowers, gods, the prow of a ship. A bird's flung open wings. This was an eastern room. When dawn came, it would be glorious. The armies clashed. The center of Arryn's vanguard coalesced around him. But the edges, as planned, disintegrated, the soldiers appearing to retreat into the forest. The left and right flanks of the Valorian cavalry hurtled straight into the open spaces along the road that the edges of Arryn's vanguard had hidden. Valorian horses impaled their stomachs on the sharpened staves Arryn had had driven into the mud. The Emperor set down a fox. He examined the game in play.
Things don't look so good for you, he told Kestrel.
A movement amid all the others, the torque of bodies, the muddy struggle, collapse, rise, murder, caught Arryn's attention. On the periphery of battle, where gutted warhorses flailed, there was some rabbit-like thing. He couldn't look directly. He was too busy kneeing his horse out of the way of a rearing Valorian stallion's plunging hooves, then grappling with the stallion's rider. Distracted, Arryn seized the rider's arm. Not a rabbit, much too large for a rabbit. Still, that impression of something, someone out of place, a softness, an innocence. Arryn felt the arm pop from its shoulder. The rider screamed, but Arryn wasn't paying attention. He impatiently killed the Valorian. He'd seen now what that strange movement far off to the side of the road was, among the bloody staves. It was Varex. He was struggling to free his leg, trapped beneath the body of his fallen horse. He was easy prey. Arryn saw his soldiers see the prince, but not see him as a prince, not as the one they were warned not to kill. This? A prince? Covered in mud, his only visible feature that straw-colored Valorian hair, Varex tugged, all thin limbs and terror. He didn't see the Dacran archer's taut bow, arrow knocked and drawn. Arryn was too far away. He shouted, "No!" But the word was lost in the roar of war. The archer aimed and released her arrow.
"I almost wish I'd lose," the Emperor mused. "It'd be a novel experience. Is it wrong for me to hope that at least this game will last longer? Improve, Kestrel, or this will be over too soon."
Kestrel reminded herself that there are ways to lose, even if one holds the highest hand. She played her tile. Helpless, Arryn watched the arrow slice a low, true path toward Varex. It struck him, glancing off his metal armor. Undaunted, the archer knocked another arrow.
"Get down,"
Arryn willed as he tried to force his way to the edge of the road. He'd never reach Varex in time.
"Use your horse as a shield."
But Varex, who now saw how the cloud of danger around him had condensed to the point of an arrowhead, froze. Arryn's gaze swiveled back to the archer, whose face underwent a curt shift of emotion just after she loosed the arrow. Her expression slackened with horror. Arryn saw what she saw, Roshar, hurtling toward the Valorian prince and into the path of the arrow. Roshar flattened Varex into the mud. The arrow sailed over his shoulder. Then Risha's brother raged at the stunned Valorian, dragged him out from under the horse, and hauled him toward the cover of the trees. They were both silent now, playing in concentration. The Emperor reached for a second shiny tile. The stained glass windows glowed, and something eased open inside Kestrel. As color seeped into the room, she felt an unexpected wish. She wished her father were here.
"You, who seek your own father's death."
But she didn't. She found that she couldn't, no matter how he had hurt her. She wished that he could see her play and win, that he could see what she saw now. A window is just a window, colored glass, mere glass. But in the sun it becomes more. She would show him and say, "Love should do this." "And you too," she would tell him, because she could no longer deny that it remained true in spite of everything. "I love you, too." After Roshar and Varex had vanished into the trees, Arryn stopped thinking. He rarely did in battle. It was easier to give himself over. The pressure inside was a good one. His body obeyed it. The staves had ruined the Valorian strategy. It was impossible to flank Arryn's army, which became a solid column that thrust up the road. The edges of Arryn's vanguard began to work forward, fighting to reach the unprotected, muddy sides of the road on which the Valorian stood. With a little luck, Arryn would flank them. When his sword cut an enemy open, Arryn thought that he would have chosen no other god to rule him, that none of the hundred could please him so well.
"A gift," he thought. "This is nothing," Death said. "Did I not make you a promise? Have you not kept faith with me in hopes of this very moment? See what I have for you."
Arryn looked. Just a few paces away, unhorsed, helmet gone, stood General Trajan. This was taking too long. It was full dawn. The stained windows were wild now, lurid with color. Kestrel had reached the end of her line of play. She held a worthy hand, yet dreaded exposing her tiles to the Emperor. It didn't matter what tiles she held. All that mattered was that the game was over, and that the Emperor appeared relaxed, lids half lowered in anticipation, his dark eyes liquid.
"Show me," he said.
Arryn spurred his horse forward. The general saw him and stood tall, Aaron's mind went blank. He heard nothing, not even death, and he should have been listening, because at the last possible moment, the general fell to one knee and drove his sword deep into the chest of Aaron's horse. As slowly as possible, Kestrel turned her last tile. Four spiders. The Emperor didn't smile. She almost wished that he had. He closed his eyes once, and when he opened them, their expression was even worse than his smile. He displayed his winning hand. Four tigers. Aaron was thrown from his shrieking horse. His head rang against the road, and rang and rang. Perspiration glimmered on the Emperor's upper lap. He touched it, glanced at his fingers strangely, then returned his attention to Kestrel. She scraped her chair back. He swept her dagger from the table and had it up to her throat in one swift movement. He pricked the skin, a tiny trickle of blood. She'd been stupid. Her plan had been stupid. A fool's gamble. Yet her mind kept scrabbling for an idea, something else, anything else that could reverse her mistake or make happen what should have already happened.
"Don't take defeat too badly," he said. "If it's any consolation, I had no intention of ever fulfilling my agreement, even if you'd won. But the pleasure of the game was great. Now, sit."
Her legs gave out beneath her.
"Let's discuss what you owe."
Aaron felt the hum of metal in the air. He rocked his body out of its path, heard the general's sword strike the road. Aaron shoved himself to his feet. The Emperor lowered back into his seat. Kestrel stared at his winning hand, lightheaded with fear.
"Does the sight of this trouble you?"
Her dagger still in one hand, the Emperor turned his tiles face down. Then he paused, frowning at their backs. He touched one of the two shiny ones, then flipped Kestrel's hand over, studying her tiles' backs. He found, in the boneyard, the two remaining marked tiles.
"What is this?"
She made an involuntary sound. He batted the air as if at an invisible insect. Colored light beamed into the room. The four tiles shone clearly.
"You cheated," he muttered. "How could you cheat and still lose?"
Aaron swung at the general, who cut the blow wide, deflecting it easily, holding it in a semi-bind that forced Aaron's sword low. Aaron's guard was open. The general was quick, his parry swift. The man's steel was so sharp that Aaron didn't feel at first when it cut him. The Emperor licked his dry lips. He turned over the two marked tiles in the boneyard, a wolf, a snake.
"These are good tiles. Why would you mark tiles and not take them for yourself?"
He swallowed. The knot of cartilage in his throat bobbed. Kestrel saw him begin to understand. His body began to understand, too. He lunged for her. The sword nicked the side of Aaron's neck, just below the ear. It would have taken off his head if he hadn't recoiled in time. Aaron had been looking at the general's face, without really seeing it. He saw it now. He saw that the man knew exactly who he was, and that he longed for Aaron's death, almost as much as Aaron longed for his. The Emperor knocked over the wine. He seized up against the table, hand clamped around Kestrel's dagger. She stepped back from the table as he shuddered against it. She felt a relief, so deep that it didn't even feel like relief. It plunged straight into exhaustion.
"I lied,"
Kestrel told him. The Emperor tried to push himself upright. She thought he might be trying to do something with the dagger, but his arm had gone rigid. It thumped into the spilled red wine.
"I lied when I said I hadn't come to murder you."
His eyes were wide, stark.
"It never mattered whether I won or lost the game," Kestrel said. "Only how long the poison would take to kill you. It comes from a tiny eastern worm. In its purest form, the poison is clear. It dries to a shine. I painted it onto four bite and sting tiles. You touched them."
Foam dribbled from his locked mouth. His breath rasped. It became glottal, the sound of bubbles popping.
Then it ended. Aaron struck back. As they fought, viciously silent words thudded in his blood. Mother, father, sister, Kestrel. Aaron didn't care that the blows his sword hammered against the man's metal body were useless, that there was no art to this, that nothing would pierce the armor, that a few smashed buckles where the general's armor joined was no victory. He could see too little of the man's flesh, couldn't reach it, and he desperately wanted to make him bleed. If he couldn't carve into the general, Aaron would bludgeon him. He'd beat until something broke. "The buckles," Death said. Aaron shifted the path of his sword in mid-swipe and curved it down toward the elbow of the general's sword arm, aiming right for where the broken buckles of the general's arm guard flapped loose. Aaron sheared the man's arm off at the elbow. Blood pumped onto Aaron. If the general made a sound, Aaron didn't hear it. He was warm and wet. The general fell. He lay blinking up at the sun, at Aaron, his eyes glazed, mouth moving as if speaking, but Aaron heard nothing. For a moment, Aaron faltered. But there was nothing of her in this man, this enemy at his feet. Aaron drew back his sword, more power than necessary for the death blow. He wanted to pour himself into this act. Vengeance, wine dark, thick. It flooded Aaron's lungs. Those light brown eyes, on him. There was that. That one thing that Kestrel shared with her father. Aaron heard himself speak. His voice sounded far away, as if some part of him had left this road and was as high as the sun, looking down on the half that he had left on Earth. He said, "Kestrel asked me to do this." For she had. Aaron was a boy, a slave, a grown man, free. He was all of this at once, and something else, too. He realized it only now, as he plunged his sword down toward the general's throat. He hadn't been blessed by the god of death. Aaron was the god. 40. But he stopped. Regret wasn't the right word for what he felt later. Disbelief, maybe. Sometimes, even years after the war, he'd tear out of sleep, sweating, still trapped in the nightmare where he had butchered the father of the woman he loved. "But you didn't," she would tell him. "You didn't. Tell me. Say it again. Tell me what you did." Trembling, he would. His brain had been a glass ball. Nothing in it but echoes. His mother's scent, father's voice. How Anira's gaze had held him from across the room, and her eyes said, "Survive." They said, "Love," and, "I'm sorry." They said, "Little brother." And then silence. It became silent in Aaron's head as he stood on the road. He stopped hearing voices. He thought about how it had seemed strange that Risha would plot the Emperor's death, yet refused to kill him herself. Aaron understood now. He knew how it was to have no family, like living in a house with no roof. Even if Kestrel were here and begged him, "Let your sword fall. Do it. Please, now." Aaron wasn't sure that he could make her an orphan. And he wasn't sure that she would beg that if she were gazing down as he did on the graying face of her dying father, the man's eyes sky bright as he tried to speak, his remaining hand fumbling against his chest, just above his heart. A throbbing radiance burned inside Aaron. He hadn't realized the pitch revenge could reach, how murder could come this close to desire. He felt his eyes sting, because he knew what he was going to do. He didn't want to be here. He wondered why we can't remember when our mothers carried us inside them. The dark and steady heart, how it was the whole of the world, and no one harmed us, and we harmed no one. Aaron thought that if he didn't kill this man, his memory of his mother would fade. It already had, over time. Someday she would be as far away as a star. But he couldn't do it. He had to do it. "Tell me what you did." Aaron dropped his sword, dropped to his knees, yanked the woven baldric from the fallen man's shoulder, and used it to make a tourniquet, to save the person he hated most. After the battle, and after Rashar had accepted the Valorian surrender, when Arryn was sick with worry because Kestrel hadn't yet returned from Scythia, he went to the healer's tent. The general was asleep, his cauterized arm swathed in bandages, his armor removed. A drug had been forced down him. It had been a violent scene. Even now, asleep, the man was under guard and bound in chains at the ankles, his remaining hand strapped tight to his side. Arryn tugged at his hair until his scalp hurt. If Kestrel wasn't back by noon, he was going to ride to Scythia. His brain was crawling in his skull. His stomach was a shriveled lump. He hated seeing the general. He hated seeing even Varix, whom he halfway liked, limping around the camp, teeming with worry, for Risha, but also for Kestrel, which made Arryn feel absurdly possessive, as if Varix were trying to rob him by feeling in any way similar to Arryn. Arryn became insufferable. He knew it, but he was constantly having to wrestle down the knowledge that if something had happened to Kestrel, his heart would turn to salt. He didn't know what to do with his hands as he looked down at the sleeping general. Arryn thrust them into his pockets before they went for the throat. He reminded himself why he had come. He ripped open the man's jacket. Arryn reached for the inside breast pocket, located exactly where the man had tried to touch his chest as he had lain bleeding on the road. Arryn's fingers met paper. He pulled it out. Its texture swayed soft from having been handled so much. It had been unfolded and folded many times. It was sheet music. At first, Arryn didn't understand what he looked at. Kestrel's handwriting, Harani script, musical notation in crisp black. His own name leaped off the page. Dear Arryn. Then he recognized the music as the sonata Kestrel had been studying when he'd entered her music room at the Imperial Palace in late spring. It had been the last time he'd seen her before the Tundra. He'd thought it would be the last time he would ever see her. Arryn hastened from the tent. He couldn't read the letter here. But he didn't know if he could read it anywhere, if any place would be private enough, because being alone meant he'd still be with himself, and he hated to remember how he'd left Kestrel that day and what had befallen her after. He was desperate to read it. He couldn't bear to read it. He resented that her father had kept it. He wondered what it meant that her father had kept it. Arryn was only vaguely aware of having stumbled through the noisy camp and into the woods. The thought of reading the letter felt like a violation, like he'd be reading a letter meant for someone else. Yet it had been addressed to him. Dear Arryn, Arryn read.
Are you all right?
Arryn glanced up at Rashar, then returned his attention to the horse. He ran a hand down the inside of its front left leg and picked up the hoof, cupping its front. With his free hand, he cleaned the hoof with a pick, brushed it off, and used a knife to probe the outer edges of the hoof, looking for the source of the problem. Steam rose from a nearby bucket of hot, salted water. It was near noon.
Arryn.
Just thinking. Kestrel's written words still radiated through him, making him feel larger inside than he had been before, as if he'd swallowed the sun, and it somehow fit, and blazed and ached, and left him dazzled, half-blind, but still seeing things more clearly than before.
Well, stop it, Rashar said. You've been looking either doer or dreamy, and neither really suits the victorious leader of his free people.
Arryn snorted. The horse, feeling his knife touch a sore spot, tried to pull her hoof away. He held it fast, supporting it from below with his knee.
You could at least make a rousing speech, Rashar said. Can't. I'm riding to Scythia.
Rashar made a strangled sound.
Not on this horse, Arryn said. She's lame. What are you doing? She was limping. It hurt to look at her. An abscess, I think. She must have stepped on something sharp. Arryn, you're not a damn farrier. Someone else can do this.
Sah, Arryn hissed in sympathy when he found the abscess. The horse tried again to tug away, but he punctured the sealed wound, which instantly dribbled black pus. He worked on opening the abscess, then pressed the rest of the pus out.
Bring that bucket closer, will you? Oh, certainly. I live to please.
Aaron lowered the hoof into the bucket's hot water. The horse, already in pain, stamped, splashing the water as she reared her head. But Aaron grabbed the halter and brought her head down, soothing her as he watched the foot to make sure it stayed in the bucket.
Aaron, why are you so transparent? Whenever you worry, you start fixing things. Draining nasty gunk from a hoof is the least of it. I don't know what's worse, watching you do that or knowing how hard it will always be for you to keep yourself to yourself.
Aaron stroked the horse's neck. She stamped again, but began to calm.
We won, Rashar said. And Kestrel is fine. We've discussed this. That poison is highly toxic. But she's not back. She will be. You need to seize your political moment. If you don't, someone else will.
Aaron squinted at him.
You call me transparent as if that's a bad thing, but I don't need to make a speech for my people to see what I am.
Roshar shut his mouth. He looked ready to say something else, then didn't, because Kestrel and Risha rode into camp. 41. The army moved at a slow pace toward the city, some on foot, and many wounded. Kestrel stayed away from the wagons that carried them.
I can't see him, she told Aaron when the army paused to rest. But part of her wanted to use this time to see her father.
You don't have to, Aaron said.
In the silence that followed, as they walked away from the wagons, fragments of everything he had told her gained shape and terribly vivid color. Her father's severed arm, Aaron's lost vengeance, the letter that she hadn't even recognized when Aaron gave it to her. It was a moment before Kestrel realized that a jittery energy had come over Aaron. He was biting his lower lip, and his hands were making stunted gestures, as if he were trying to speak but couldn't. Finally, he said,
You asked for his death. I didn't do it. Should I have? Did I do the wrong thing?
A gentle feeling flowed into her. She caught his erratic hands and held them between hers.
No, she said. You didn't.
That letter. She read and reread it in the high summer grasses on the sides of the road, at night by lamplight. The pen's ink had aged, gone brownish. She imagined her father reading under the sun during the campaign. Spots of the paper had a waxy transparency. The residue of oil used to polish a weapon. Her father liked to clean his own dagger. She searched for meaning in the smudges of dirty fingerprints under certain words, but nothing, really, was evidence of anything except the urgent scrawl of her own handwriting. The bottom half of the letter was warped with rusted blood, the final sentences lost. Kestrel couldn't remember what she'd written there. Like a worn map, the letter folded instantly under the slightest pressure. The paper looked quiet in her hand, tucked in on itself. Kestrel wanted to reach through time and comfort the girl who'd written it, even if the only comfort she could offer would be understanding. She wanted to imagine a different story, one where her father read the letter and understood it, too, and returned it to his daughter, telling her that she should never have had to write anything like that.
I love you. I'd do anything for you, the letter said.
And it was hard for Kestrel to keep from crumpling the paper in her fist when she realized that these words were what she had always wanted her father to say to her. 3 days from the city, the army had made camp for the night. Kestrel went to the healer's tent. Her father noticed the moment she entered. He flinched, then met her gaze, and she didn't know what was right to feel. The sort of soft, heavy comfort that touched her at the sight of her father, simply because he was her father, or the rage in her chest, or how she wanted to mourn his maimed arm and wanted to tell him that he deserved it.
"Why did you keep my letter?" she asked.
He said nothing. She asked again. He turned his face from her. She kept asking until she heard her voice crumbling and thought that Risha had been wrong when she'd said that forgiveness was like mud, as if it could take whatever shape you needed. It was hard. It was stone. She walked away from the tent. Varric said that he and Risha were leaving. They wanted to ride to the eastern plains, and maybe sail from Dapra's eastern coast to see what lay in the unexplored waters beyond. He had no wish to inherit the Empire. He asked that rumors of his death be spread. He saw Kestrel's fallen expression.
You think I should go back to the capital instead, and become Emperor?
Honestly, I don't want you to go anywhere. I'll miss you. His brown eyes warmed.
I'll visit. Risha, too. She wants to train you in your weapon of choice until you feel properly dangerous.
Kestrel opened her mouth to say that'd be a useless effort, but then it struck her that it might not be, and whether it was or wasn't didn't matter as much as the happiness the offer gave her. I like her, too. They were leaning against the trunk of a very broad tree near the encampment. White spores from its flowering branches floated down. She wondered if a Harani would think this the sign of a god, and if so, which one? I'm sorry, she told Varix. He knew what she meant.
I had no love for my father. He certainly had none for me.
Still,
I'm not sure what else you could have done, if anything.
He slouched against the bark.
I feel worse about being relieved.
A spore landed on the tip of his boot, then floated away. In a low voice, he added,
And a bit of a coward. I worry that if I became Emperor, I'd become like him.
Not you. Never.
And guilty, because I'm abandoning a country that might collapse on itself. It's not clear who'll rule now.
I bet you have some ideas. I can think of a few senators who'd claw their way to power. Or the captain of the guard. I don't remember everyone at court, though, or who owes whom, or bears a grudge. You could give me a clearer picture, and I could, well, keep an eye on the situation in the capital. He raised his brows.
A spy again, Kestrel.
Spy master, maybe. He picked up a thin, fallen twig and snapped it into tiny stacks. I think Arryn needs one, she said.
You'd be the best.
I wish, however, that you didn't always risk yourself.
You're too fond of a gamble.
She shrugged helplessly. I am who I am. Affection tinged his smile. Then he sobered and said,
I used to believe I could stomach taking my father's place. But Risha would be miserable. I would, too.
Kestrel, suddenly fierce, said,
Then be happy. I will, he said, if you will.
Feathery white fluff came down from the tree as he described the political intricacies of the Valorian court, and then told her about how the puppy he'd given her at court had grown into an enormous sweet-tempered dog living with a family in the foothills of the Valorian mountains. There were small children who adored her, even when she chewed their shoes. Maris, a young courtier Kestrel had intensely disliked until she found that actually she didn't, had married well and was gleefully smug about it. As for Jess, Varric said that she had gone to the Southern Isles at the start of the war.
I wish I knew more, he said.
Kestrel longed to see her. She wondered if she ever would, and if they could mend the things wrong between them.
I saw you go to the healer's tent the other day, Varric said.
He won't talk with me.
Try again.
When Risha and Varix left, 2 days before the army would reach the city, Kestrel kept her smile as she kissed their cheeks. At first it was hard to be strong in that way, and not let the farewell overwhelm her. But then she noticed Rishar, who had avoided his little sister since her return, as if afraid of her, lingering nearby. Risha approached him and whispered something Kestrel couldn't hear. Rishar's expression eased. He didn't speak in reply. He simply clasped Risha's hands and kissed them. Kestrel thought that maybe she had been wrong and Risha had been wrong about forgiveness, that it was neither mud nor stone, but resembled more the drifting white spores. They came loose from the trees when they were ready, soft to the touch, but made to be let go, so that they could find a place to plant and grow. She went to the tent again. This time her father spoke before she could.
Give me your dagger.
Hot tears rushed to her eyes.
Don't you dare. Unbind my hand. Give me your dagger.
No,
Just this one last thing.
You can't ask me to help you kill yourself. He no longer looked at her. Why did you keep my letter? She asked yet again.
You know why.
What? Regret?
That's not the right word.
Then what?
There are no words.
Find some.
I can't.
Now. He swallowed.
I want to. I didn't know how everything would become impossible. This is what happens when you destroy the thing most precious to you.
You chose to do it.
Yes.
Why? He didn't say, but his eyes became clear, hard shells, and she knew that it hadn't been only his code of honor that had made him tell the Emperor of her treason. Her father had wanted to hurt her, because she had hurt him. He said,
It didn't seem real when I was doing it, like I wasn't awake.
Do you know, she whispered, what they did to me in the mines? He closed his eyes. She described it. He let her. Water slid from beneath his eyelids.
Kestrel,
he said finally.
You know that there is only one solution. I can't be a father to you.
But you are.
There is no place for me here. Am I to be a prisoner for the rest of my life?
This had been discussed, loudly. Rashar was in favor of a public execution. Aaron had lost his temper in a way that Kestrel hadn't seen in a long time, had shouted back that the general's fate was Kestrel's choice alone. I don't know, Kestrel told her father. There was a silence. She said, How can you not even ask for forgiveness?
Impossible.
Ask. For a long time, he said nothing.
I can't ask for something no one could give. I ask for mercy.
Her vision blurred, and Kestrel knew that forgiveness and mercy would take years for them both, and that she needed every single minute of that time. She said that she still loved him, because it was true. He owed her better answers than the ones he had given, and even if he never had them, it was her right to keep asking. She would never give him her dagger. I tried so hard to live in your world, she told him. Now it's your turn to live in mine. 42. Aaron should have expected it, but somehow didn't. So many flowers. All the summer blooms must have been cut from the gardens, which would be naked for weeks. When the army came through the gate, a roar vibrated the stone walls, and Aaron flinched in surprise, hands tightening on the reins for the tiniest moment, believing that the sound meant danger. Then he saw the glowing faces of people thronging the streets and thought, Ah, happy. Which made him happy, and as Kestrel smiled at him from her seat on Javelin, a pink petal clinging to her cheek, it occurred to him that he might have to grow comfortable with happiness, because it might not abandon him this time. Then Kestrel's head turned, and he saw her survey the Dakran Harani army unfurled behind them in Lahirin's main street, a tension in the line of her mouth. She said, I'm not sure it's wise to bring all the soldiers within the city walls.
This is everyone's victory. Everyone must be honored.
I know.
But?
Our eastern allies outnumber us. He knew what she was getting at.
They always have.
If they want this country, it'd be easy for them to take it, especially from within the city walls. Aaron glanced at Rashar, who'd ridden ahead to meet the queen.
I trust him.
Yes, I know. Aaron paused his horse. Javelin stopped too. Flowers flurried down around them. He said,
It would hurt me to suspect him.
That's why I do it for you. A cloth dropped onto his head from above, from a window of one of the tall, narrow homes near the market. Startled, blind, Aaron tugged it from his face, his horse shying beneath him. It was an old Harani flag, stitched with the royal crest. Aaron said,
But the royal line is gone.
They're looking for something to call you, Kestrel said, nudging Javelin forward.
Not this. It's not right.
Don't worry, they'll find the right words to describe you.
And you.
Oh, that's easy.
It is.
It seemed impossible to name everything she was to him. Kestrel's expression was serious, luminous. He loved to see her like this. They'll say that I'm yours, she told him, just as you are mine. When Sarsine saw Kestrel, her eyes narrowed to mere cracks, and Kestrel became very conscious that Sarsine was a tall woman. For someone with a reputation for being so smart, Sarsine said, you act like you haven't a thought in your head. Did it never occur to you that I'd worry when you disappeared from the city with no word?
I didn't exactly mean to leave.
Oh, so it just happened.
Yes.
The gods made you do it. Kestrel laughed.
Maybe they did.
Then, earnestly, she said, I'm sorry, Sarsine. Sarsine folded her arms. Then make it up to me.
How?
Sarsine's expression softened. Now there was an inquisitive gleam in her eye. Start with the night you left. End with this very moment. And tell me everything. So Kestrel did. There was to be a city-wide feast to celebrate the military victory, with a banquet at the governor's palace, where Queen Inishanawe would preside. The cooks in Arryn's house were hard at work, slaughtering every chicken in the yard, pulping a rosti fruit, and thumping dough against flowered tables. Arryn was in the still room, trying to soothe the anxiety of a woman who was saying that she had just preserved the jams, and must all of them be used for the banquet, every last one? She didn't think the Dacrans appreciated Ilya fruit. Why serve something they wouldn't love as much as the Harani did? It would be best, surely, to keep at least those jars for winter. Trying to explain the politics of such lavish consumption tangled Arryn up in frustrated half-sentences, because it didn't make much sense to him, either, to consume every edible thing in one night. And then he heard Rashar's accented voice in Harani, drifting down the hall from the kitchens.
You don't understand. The piece of meat must be the finest, cut from the loin, seasoned with this spice, not that one.
Arryn excused himself, told the woman he'd discuss jams later, and followed the prince's voice.
And it must be well roasted on the outside, almost charred yet bloody inside, bright pink. Listen, this is crucial. If anything goes wrong, the banquet will be ruined.
Arryn entered the main kitchen to find the prince haranguing the head cook, who slid a half-lidded look of annoyed sufferance at Arryn.
There you are, Rashar beamed. I need your help, Arryn.
For the preparation of meat?
It's very important. You must impress this importance upon your cook here. The fate of political relations between my country and yours hangs in the balance.
Because of meat.
It's for his tiger, said the cook.
Arryn palmed his face, eyes squeezed shut.
Your tiger.
He's very particular, said Rashar.
You can't bring the tiger to the banquet.
Little Arryn has missed me. I will not be parted from him.
Would you consider changing his name?
No.
What if I begged?
Not a chance.
Rashar, the tiger has grown.
And what a sweet big boy he is.
You can't bring him into a dining hall filled with hundreds of people.
He'll behave. He has the mien and manners of a prince.
Oh, like you?
I resent your tone.
I'm not sure you can control him.
Has he ever been aught but the gentlest of creatures? Would you deny your namesake the chance to bear witness to our victorious celebration? And, of course, to the vision of you and Kestrel, side by side, Harani and Valurian, a love for the ages. The stuff of songs, Arryn. How you'll get married and make babies. Gods, Rashar, shut up.
Even if Arryn hadn't known how much Kestrel hated to enter the palace built for the Valurian governor during the period of colonization, he would have seen it in her tense shoulders, the way she touched the dagger at her hip, and practically snarled at Rashar when the prince had suggested that surely she could forego, this one night, the barbarism of openly bearing a weapon. Arryn gave him a warning look. The prince pretended to look innocently confused, then shrugged and moved to walk ahead of them, the half-grown tiger slinking at his heels. The tiger was eerily docile, even for a young one raised by humans. It pushed its head up under Rashar's hand like a house cat. Aaron watched its solid sway, the already powerful shoulder blades rising and falling under its fur. Aaron sensed, but couldn't name the origin of what made people, animals too, apparently, long to follow the prince. With an uncomfortable prickle, he suspected that if he asked and Rashar deigned to give a straight answer, the prince would say that whatever it was, Aaron possessed it too. A strange feeling, as if filaments trailed from Aaron's body. A thousand fishing lines snagging attention, here and there, little tugs, people caught on the lines. The way sometimes people couldn't look him in the eye, and when they did, they became fish trying to breathe air. He wished it weren't like that. He knew it would be necessary. Rashar and the tiger disappeared inside, leaving Kestrel and Aaron alone on the path. Kestrel was stiff, her delicate shoes planted in the walkway's gravel. She had lifted the hem of her storm-green skirts, the gesture of a lady, but he saw how she made fists of the fabric.
"I'm sorry," he said,
guessing what troubled her, the memory of the first winter rebellion. Her dead friends, Aaron's deception, the halls of the governor's palace choked with corpses. She gave him a narrow look.
"Part of you isn't sorry."
He couldn't deny it. But she softened and said, "I'm not innocent either. I too feel sorry, and not sorry about things I've done." She let her dress's hem fall to the stones and touched three fingers to the back of his hand. Aaron forgot for a moment where he was and what they were discussing. A marvel that such a light touch could feel like a whole caress that his body could ignite so easily. Now she looked amused.
"Let's leave."
He slid a hand beneath her loose hair and thumbed the slope of her neck, feeling the fluttery pulse there. Her expression changed, amusement melting into slow pleasure. He said,
"Let's not go in."
"Aaron," she sighed, "we must go in."
Her slightly parted mouth closed again into a tense line.
"What else is troubling you?"
"The queen hasn't said a word to you."
"Well," Aaron said, uncomfortable, thinking of various reasons for Anisha's silence.
"All of the Dacrans are too quiet."
"Not Rashar."
"Him, too. He just says a lot without meaning much."
Aaron paused, then said,
"I believe in our alliance."
"I want to, too."
He offered her his hand. They went inside. They sat at a table on a raised dais in the dining hall, the four of them in a line, Aaron and the queen occupying the center, and Kestrel and Rashar to their sides, an arrangement Rashar maneuvered without seeming to as the hundreds of people already seated watched them. The queen gave Aaron a sidelong glance, her black eyes unreadable. She said nothing and didn't look at him again. Rashar, the tiger curled at his feet, barely touched his food as the first courses were served, but instead drank the green Dacran liqueur he favored. Aaron saw, beyond the silhouette of the queen, how Rashar clenched and released the glass. His fingers were unsteady.
"Brother,"
the queen spoke as if nudging him.
"Leave me alone."
He refilled his cup. When people entered bearing the main course, including, Aaron noted with wry amusement, the fastidiously prepared loin for the tiger on its very own platter, Rashar stood, swaying a little. The room hushed. He scanned the faces, Dacran and Harani alike.
"People of the Hundred,"
he said, using an ancient Harani phrase Aaron was surprised he knew.
"Who leads you?"
So many cried Aaron's name that it no longer sounded like his name.
"Do you trust your country to him?"
"Yes."
"Would you say that Haran is his?"
"Yes." Sudden distrust slicked down Aaron's spine. Rashar raised his hand to quiet the roaring crowd, and Aaron was reminded of Cheat, relishing his role as an auctioneer. A stone rose in his throat. Kestrel's hand tightened on his, but Aaron no longer felt wholly there.
"Enough," said the queen,
not so much in reprimand, but rather as if telling him to get to the point.
I have fought for Aaron, bled for him. I hold him in my heart. I have even named my tiger after him. No small honor. And yet we have a problem. Aaron of Harran was not always my friend, and once committed an offense against me that caused my queen to award me control over all he owns, his life, his belongings, and, since you say he possesses it, his country. I've been told to take from Aaron what is due to me. I've been told it is mine by law. Must I? Yes. Will my people support my claim with force if necessary? They will. Will my queen rise in admiration of me? Oh, indeed. And so I must. No, Aaron. Sit down. Otherwise you'll make an ass out of yourself. And that role is mine. I see my tiger's meal is here. You, there. Yes, you, with the platter. Bear it forth.
Kestrel laughed. Aaron felt, rather than saw, that she had relaxed beside him, aglow with mirth. He sank back into his chair, because now he too understood Rishara's game. He wanted to sag with relief. He wanted to strangle the prince and thank him.
There.
Rishar flourished a hand at the platter.
Aaron the tiger's meal. Since I've been ordered to take from Aaron what belongs to Aaron, I shall.
Rishar returned to his seat, platter in hand, and commenced cutting the meat. He took a bite.
This is excellent. So well done. Now, as for what belongs to Aaron the human, I relinquished any claim to it. Nothing of his was ever mine to take, nor will ever be. What belongs to him, I defend his right to keep, out of my love for him, and his for me.
He looked directly at the queen as he ate.
This is delicious, exactly the way I like it.
The queen forced a smile.
Oh, and would someone bring another slice of loin? Raw, please. My tiger is hungry.
43.
I don't want you to go.
Waves rocked against the pier. The sun was too bright. Weathered boards creaked beneath Aaron's feet.
Only because you enjoy a good bully. Someone to make you behave as you ought.
No, Rishar.
You know well enough what to do now. You'll be fine.
That's not why.
Why, you'll miss me. I admit that the impending absence of my keen wit would make anyone sad.
Not exactly.
Now I'm getting sad, just thinking about how it would feel to be parted from my sweet self. Lucky me, I will always have my own company.
What you said at the banquet was true.
Everything I say is true.
That I love you.
Rishar's face went still.
I said that. You know that you did. That was more for the drama of the moment.
Liar.
I am, aren't I?
Rishar said slowly.
I really am. Aaron,
his voice roughened.
You'll see me again.
Soon,
Aaron told him and embraced him. Then they broke away, and maybe some would have thought that the sun was a little cruel, for how its brightness allowed no subterfuge in their expressions, and everything that could be seen was shown. But Aaron thought that it was a kindness. He wanted to be a mirror, to reflect what Rishar was to him. A launch waited in the water below. Aaron wished him fair tides. He watched until the launch reached Rishar's ship, then watched as the ship, with the rest of the entire Dokran fleet, left his city's bay. He glimpsed Sarsine as he walked through the city. She had a laden basket. It dragged at her arm, making its weight known even from far away. Her faintly harried expression softened at the sight of him. Aaron took the basket from her.
Coming or going?
I've an errand here, and won't be home until late.
Shall I guess what brings you to town?
You can try. He peeked in the basket. Bread, still warm from the oven, a bottle of liquor, long, flat pieces of wood, rolls of gauze.
A picnic with a wounded soldier?
Sarsine, he teased.
Is it true love? What's the wood for?
Wait, don't tell me. I'm not sure I want to know.
She swatted him. The Cartwright's oldest daughter has a broken arm. It dropped ice to the bottom of his stomach. He thought of the ruined bodies he'd seen,